What happens when you struggle with substance use for the greater part of your life? Stay tuned on this episode of The 1 in 5 as Ty LaFountain shares his years-long battle with substance use and how he went from feeling helpless to helping others. Hey y'all, welcome to the 1 in 5, the show for those who want to know how to be healthy, how to stay healthy, and how to promote health in your community. I'm your host, Adam Renshaw, and in today's show, we have Ty LaFountain, and he is going to be sharing his story about addiction and recovery. Welcome, Ty. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, man?
Yeah, hi. How's it going, Adam? My name is Ty LaFountain, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. I'm a certified behavioral health peer support specialist at One Health. And here coming up in about 2 months, on April 3rd, will be my five-year mark for my recovery date.
Wow, 5 years, man.
Yep.
Strong work.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're a certified peer support, behavioral health peer support specialist.
Yep.
But you're also a recovery doula. Are you certified in that, or are you still in the training?
I'm still in the training for the recovery doula. So I've had two births. I need one more birth to get certified. And then I'll be certified. And
congratulations. Yeah. And thanks. For those of you who have listened to the Megan Dobbs story podcast that we did, Ty was on that. And he spoke from the perspective of being her peer support during that time. And that was that your first recovery doula?
She was my first doula mama.
So yep. If you haven't listened to that episode, please go and do, because Ty talks about his bag of tricks in that episode that he had. It's kind of a funny story. So
yeah,
awesome, man. Well, let's get into it then, dude. Why don't we have you start and tell us your story? Why don't you start with when you were younger, and let's go from there.
Yeah. So I'll just go ahead and start off once again. So my name is Ty LaFountain. I was born in Lewistown, Montana. So I was born the fourth child and the youngest of four.
The baby.
The baby. Yep. And that's what they all called me, baby.
Yep, same.
My mom has multiple sclerosis. My father, undiagnosed substance use disorder. My mom, I grew up, they split up when I was very young. My mom had some major health issues. We ended up in foster care for a brief time. And then my mom got better, got us out of foster care, moved us to Great Falls. Great Falls is really where I kind of grew up my entire life.
Okay.
Mostly
with mom, or
all with mom?
All with mom.
Yep.
Okay. Do you have any memories of, you said your dad had an undiagnosed substance use issue. Do you have any memories of him using during that time, or?
So there are memories of like our childhood of, the house that we lived in had like a trap door underneath of the kitchen table, and it had a rug over it. Police or somebody would show up, and my dad would have his buddies crawl down in the basement and, tell us to sit down and be quiet.
Wow.
Don't say anything while the cops were there. A lot of partying and stuff at my, at my house.
That you were witness to.
Yeah. Okay. And then, as I grew up, most of my memories of my father were, since him and my mom were split, were of him, he was like the weekends he was supposed to come pick us up. And so I get all excited, pack my bags and go sit out on the porch and wait for my dad, who either never showed up or when he would show up, my mom wouldn't let us go with him. And for the longest time, I held these resentments against my mom. I thought it was my mom just, you know, trying to like punish my dad, or
she doesn't want us to be with him.
Right, right. Okay. And later on, you know, I find out that, you know, my dad was drunk when he would show up, and my mom was only protecting us, you know, but I didn't understand that until, you know, I got older and was able to understand that.
And it caused resentment against your mom.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's got to be tough. I mean, your mom's got MS and she's trying to raise four kids on her own. It's hard to pull us out of our own situation, right? And see through someone else's eyes in a time like that. And then we develop these feelings, right? That are negative feelings, resentment, right? It's a powerful negative emotion that can pop up and cause us to struggle in our relationship with that parent who's going out of their way to work and provide for us, huh? Rough, dude.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit then about how you got into using substances.
Yeah. So, when we were, you know, I was in, I think like fifth grade, somewhere around there, fourth or fifth grade, we moved to a really rough neighborhood, as I said. So it's my mom with multiple sclerosis trying to raise four kids. So we grew up in pretty low poverty. We actually grew up in a house that was built by the high school for families in need. So, you know, we grew up in this poverty class, low income section. You know, it was a really rough neighborhood. My first experience in this neighborhood was, I was playing basketball at the basketball court, and, three, four kids come up and said, "Hey, you got a fight to play on this court," you know? And so that was my very first experience in that neighborhood. I had to fight. Of course I did. And then, you know, from that point, you kind of just become part of the boys, you know,
the
part of the neighborhood then. And so then, of course, I'm just kind of off and running with the wrong crowd. Started smoking marijuana at about 11, started drinking. All of that really got heavier through my high school years. Started, you know, pretty soon I'm smoking weed every day, smoking marijuana every day, drinking at least every weekend. And then, you know, really my substance use just really progressed from there. Once I, you know, got into high school, now I'm like almost drinking every day. I'm smoking weed every day. And then I'm, you know, I get out of, high school and it partied every day. I lived with five other people. We all lived in this little tiny house. I don't know how we did it, but, you know, we all worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken and, nice. Yeah, I mean, all we ever had in our fridge was just chicken and beer, and that was it. Like, we'd bring home KFC and then, you know, cases of Busch Light and stuff. And that's pretty much every day. You know,
so did you have any thought at this during this time as you're growing up? I mean, you just covered years, right, of your life right there. Did you have any thought of like, I shouldn't do this, or was it this is just normal? This is just what people do.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's what I've come to find, you know, is that everybody has their own normal. And yeah. So, you know, growing up for me, that was all normal, you know. I remember, you know, my brother, so he was a star basketball player, and he would lose basketball games, and this was one of the only times, like some of the only times that we saw our dad was he would come to my brother's basketball games, but my brother would lose and he'd be upset, and my dad would buy him beer, you know what I mean? And they'd sit out in the back of where our place was, and
that's how they'd cope.
Yeah, and they would sit there and drink beer, right? And so, I mean, this is, you know, it was just a normal for my the neighborhood that I lived in, for my family, you know, all of that.
Sure. You know, it's interesting because I, you know, I've told you a little bit about my experience with substance use too, and I was raised completely differently and still gravitated towards it. I would say I was raised in a more positive way. I guess I don't mean to say you were raised in a negative way. I know your mom did her best,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So like for me, there was always sort of a Jiminy Cricket in the back, sort of saying, is this something that you should be doing? Is this the way you should be living? And so that's why I ask, you know, did you have that sort of thought or mentality? And it's so interesting to hear, you know, that it's just, it wasn't like that for you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I just think of that, like you're saying, and I just also want to reiterate what you just said, that, you know, it's not like it was my mom's fault or my dad's fault or any,
yes,
you know,
yes,
I mean,
agreed.
My mom did the best that she could with what she had. Right. And so, you know, I know that my mom gave us the best life she could.
Right.
You know, some of that is just, you know, society and things and poverty and the lack of resources that you have when you're
sure.
in poverty and, you know.
And the group of people you choose to end up spending a lot of your time with. Right.
Right.
Yeah, the influences in your life. That's super important. So we've got weed, we've got alcohol. These are obviously a part of your life. At some point you got involved in doing some harder drugs too, you told me offline, right? Not in this episode that we're talking about right now. Was there a progression that took place? During that? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it was, I'd say I was about 20 years old and I started using cocaine, you know, drinking every day, smoking weed every day. And then pretty soon I had a friend that introduced me to opioids, so pain pills. And so, you know, just started out with Percocets and taking those. And, man, I don't know, I just got that euphoric feeling. And
absolutely.
It was like, man, this is great. And pretty soon, before you know it, I can't live without them, right? Like pretty soon I'm getting sick if I don't have them. I'm, you know, and, you know, for those who've never experienced sickness, you know, I mean, I'm talking cold sweats, you know, your skin is crawling, your
muscles feel like they're seizing up. Yes.
Yep. Your bones ache. Like, you know, it's one of the worst feelings, really. Yeah. I mean, you feel like you can't move. You don't want to move. So, I mean, I got to the point where friends and family would bring me drugs at my house because I can't even bring myself to get out of bed, you know. And just to get well, that's what we call it, is getting well. You know, people would bring me drugs and then, you know, because otherwise I just lay down in my basement and do absolutely nothing and feel miserable. And
and that's what it becomes with the opioids particularly, right? I lived with some heroin users when I was in my teenage years, and they used to talk about how they're not getting high anymore. We're not doing this to get high anymore. We're doing this to get well.
To get well, right. It's not even, yeah. And, it, you know, it becomes to where, like you just said, you're not even getting high. You're just getting well.
So you're neck deep now in substance use. You meet a girl.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I got a good construction job, and it was really hard to keep up my substance use, my pill use. So I would, you know, switch between, so I would work construction in the summers and work and then be laid off in the winter. So in the summers, I would just switch to alcohol. And then in the winters, I would go to substance use, to pills.
Because you didn't have to work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, cause it was really hard to work construction and be pill sick, you know?
Yep.
And so at one winter I decided that, I wanted to go to college. So I went to, the University of Great Falls, MSUGF, for criminal justice. I wanted to be a juvenile probation officer. Still have some passion there in that area. But I met a gal who was also going to college there. She had two kids. Her name was Stephanie. And, you know, we hit it off. I just, we started, you know, utilizing pills every day together. And we were just kind of off and running. Pretty soon, you know, summer rolls back around and I'm like, I'm not going back to work. You know, we end up having two kids. So my first child, Briley, is born. And then, about a little over a year later, Bentley was born. You know, and for those of you who've had children or, you know, who have children, that's like the most amazing experience a person can experience, that like that love, and there's no love like that out there, you know? And so,
yes, sir.
You know, this is something that I was 100% sure as this is going on and like my daughter's being born and like I'm crying instantly, like the second that I see her come out of Stephanie's womb, you know, I'm like, oh yes, like this is like, I mean, I'm bawling my eyes out, and I just feel like this is the time, like my life is going to change and I'm going to change for this little girl right here. And unfortunately my substance use disorder kind of had a different opinion, or
you know. Didn't turn out that way,
right,
necessarily. Right. So you're a parent now and you're still using. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, so I'm a parent and I'm using and I mean,
I guess, are you using in front of your kids or?
So that's the thing is, right? Like, so my substance use, had my mind so messed up that I'm thinking that I'm like this great parent, right? Because I would put my daughter in her crib where I know that she's safe. She can't get out. And I would go in the other room and I would smoke my pills. And, you know, I'm being this great parent because I'm not sitting there doing these drugs right in front of her. Right. But she's in the other room screaming. And, you know, like, I'm like, oh, dad will be there in just a minute, hon. You know, and like, I'm this great parent. Like,
sure,
I actually have myself convinced that I'm this great parent.
Because you're not doing it in front.
Right. You know, because I've sat there and watched people just do drugs right with their kids, you know, right? Sure. And, you know, here I have myself convinced that because I'm not like them,
right,
I'm this great parent.
And the standard wasn't not to be high around your kids, period. It was just don't use in front of them, right?
Right, right.
Interesting, yeah. Huh? How we can sort of pull a fast one on ourselves in situations like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I look back on that and I'm like, man, I really thought that was good parenting.
Yeah.
You know, and then I also think of all the times where I was sick, yeah, and I couldn't get myself to get out of bed. And like, so, you know, I would make like an area in my living room that I'd put my couches together and I'd put the gate up so my daughter can't get out of this area. And I would like just lay on this couch, right? And that's neglect, right? Oh, I mean, although she's right there,
yeah,
in that room, I'm still neglecting her because I'm just laying there miserable, sick, right? Yeah. I mean, I think of all of that. But yeah, my brain was just convinced I'm just this great parent.
I get it, man.
So then when CPS gets involved, you know, here right down the road, you know, CPS gets involved. Now it's the person who's called on CPS. It's their fault and it's CPS's fault and it's everybody's fault but my own, right?
Sure.
And that's where, you know, I had myself convinced that the world's just out to get me. These people shouldn't have called CPS on me. I'm this great dad, you know, sure. I don't do this right in front of my kids. You know, and all of, I mean, yeah. So,
it's,
you know, just that typical kind of substance use disorder, kind of, I blame everybody else for my stuff that are going on in my life, you know?
So did you end up losing your kids?
Yeah. So my daughter was removed. And so at this time, Stephanie's pregnant with our second, and she's continuing. I mean, I shouldn't say she. We're both continuing to use through this whole pregnancy. I mean, I'm under the thought, like, I'm not the one pregnant. I don't need to stop, right? But, you know, how is she supposed to stop if I'm not stopping either? You know, so she uses all through this pregnancy. Our son is born. He was born exposed to substances. You know, so I didn't know this, but, so my ex's sister had stolen, the baby's first poop, you know, which they test for. And I didn't even know any of this stuff. Right. So they steal this poop, and so that the hospital,
so that they wouldn't test it,
right? So the hospital can't test this, right? And so they don't even know what's wrong with our son, and he's sitting there just getting worse.
Oh, because he's going through withdrawals,
right? Right. So now he's in neonatal abstinence syndrome, you know, and so he's going through these withdrawals and getting worse day by day by day. And finally, about I think 2, maybe 3 days into it, I just approached Stephanie and said, we either you're going to tell them or I'm going to tell them, but we need to tell them because I mean it's just terrible, right?
They can't help him if they don't know what's wrong,
right?
With him,
right. So we tell them, and then of course we're not even allowed around him. You know, he's in an incubator with holes in it, and that's like we're occasionally allowed to put our hands in and you know, try to comfort him, but that's all the comforting that, and then he gets mercy flighted to, Washington, you know, and, that's a rough one, right?
Were you allowed to go with him?
No, you know, like, so we're not even really allowed to be around our kids, you know, we're, these people with substance use disorder, and we're these terrible people, right?
Sure,
That, you know, the doctors, everybody just, think we're these terrible people, right? I mean, how could you do this to these kids?
Sure.
And yeah, so you know, watching our son go on this flight and then he's gone for, you know, 2 weeks or something.
And your daughter gets taken too?
Our daughter is in foster care at this time.
Gotcha. So this Ty, along with obviously the continued substance use and some other things that are going on in your life, led to a really dark time.
Yeah.
In your life. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so as I've stated, watching your children be born is like one of the most amazing experiences you can have in your life. And then basically having that ripped out of your arms just, you know, is the exact opposite feeling, right? And now I know that earlier in my story, I had mentioned my experiences with my father, right? So now here I am doing the same thing to my kids. Ooh. That was done to me, right? And that's a tough pill to swallow right there. I can't sit here and say that I know exactly what they're going through, but I can relate, right? Like, I know what that feels like to have dad not show up to, you know, and so now I'm doing this to my kids.
Oh, man.
And that put me in a really dark place. And as much as I sat there and tried, I just couldn't stop using substances. You know, I would get a few days of sobriety and recovery, and then, you know, somebody would show up, or I'd be sick of not getting out of bed, you know, and so now at this point I'm also using meth, so, and heroin, and so I'm doing speedballs, you know, I'm doing basically, you know, and kind of insane amounts, you know, and at this point things really got dark. Okay. So just to go into that a little bit, you know, I'm homeless, staying on people's couches. And you know, I wanted all to end. Like, I honestly just wanted life to end. I was sick of waking up sick. I was tired of, and then when I did get well, I didn't even like it. I didn't even like life. I was miserable. I was paranoid. I was being hunted by the police. You know, I'm on the Great Falls Most Wanted list, you know, and on the news. And so, like, of course, it's like you're hiding everywhere that I go. So, yeah, at a point, I just, so my sister used to live behind the Holiday Inn Express, or not the Holiday Inn Express, the Holiday Inn in Great Falls. And I, every single day almost, not, I can't say every day, but almost every day, I would go from her place, walk over to the Holiday Inn, and I would sneak in and sit in the hot tub. And then I would go up the fire escape flight of stairs, and I would stand at the very top smoking cigarettes, just trying to will myself to jump off there.
Oh, man.
And I always, you know, I could never will myself to do it.
Thank God.
And it's crazy because, so I've shared this story with some of my friends now that are in the, so I'm a part of a 12-step program. And one of the guys said, while you're sitting there praying to jump off of this building, have you ever thought maybe somebody somewhere was praying for you to not? You know what I mean? And that never, you know, none of that stuff ever, you know, I always just thought I only affected myself.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So yeah, this is all.
But that mindset obviously started to change when you had those kids, right? There was something else
right
in there, and that was causing this conflict inside of you.
Huge conflict. Yeah. I mean, shame, right? Yeah, shame I'm this POS, and I am this terrible person, and I'm this terrible father, and I'm not even worthy of living and breathing this air, and it was a dark place.
So what we're starting to see, though, is we're starting to see a shift in your mindset, right? So
right.
So next, I think big thing that happened with you was you ended up in jail.
Right. I ended up. So,
which sadly is not, you know, it's not an uncommon trajectory for right. people that are using like that, right?
No, I mean, you know, I made it a long time to be honest with you, and I don't know how. But so yeah, I end up going to jail. I end up in there, and it's not, and I can't say that jail was what changed me, but
sure.
It was some of my experiences that I had in there, you know. So while I was in, my grandfather passed away, and I wasn't very close to my grandfather. But I was very close to my grandmother who lived in Lewistown. And I'm not even able to call my grandmother because the jail needs to confirm with the Fergus County coroners that my grandfather's passed away in order for me to call her. So for 2 weeks, I'm sitting there just wishing that I could at least say something to my grandmother, just be some kind of something, some kind of support, right? And that's where I thought, I don't ever want to go through this again. I mean, I'm punching windows, and they're calling codes at the, you know, and locking down the whole entire facility because I'm, you know, acting out and punching windows and just, you know, doing absurd things. And that's where my mind kind of flipped, and I thought, this is not where I want to be. You know, what if so, going back to my mom who has multiple sclerosis, right? I thought, what if something happened to my mom and I'm not able to be there? That's one of the biggest turning points. And then I just want to share the second biggest turning point was my brother who talked to me every single day while I was in there. And, you know, he was a huge part of my change, you know, teaching me things like positive affirmations and all of that. But at one point we're having this phone conversation and he hadn't talked to me for a few years. And he tells me, you know, I just want to let you know that I love you. And it's not that I didn't love you. And that's not why I wasn't talking to you. I wasn't speaking to you for years because I was scared that I was going to get that phone call that you were dead. Mm. And it was a lot easier for me to distance myself than to get that phone call and be close to you. And that really hit me. And I thought, you know, all the, like I've said, all this time I thought, I'm only affecting myself. Like, why do these people care? Like, do people get angry at me? I'm not asking them for money. I'm not asking them for anything.
I'm not ripping them off.
It's just myself, right? No, this entire time, every single person in my life that comes in contact with me, I'm affecting them.
Huge and negatively. Huge turning point, huh?
Right.
Mindset, right? More than anything, it's like we start to get out of that. Life is only about me mindset and start to be others centered and others focused and realize that our behavior is affecting other people. That's huge, man.
Right.
That's huge. What a big, big moment. So you end up back in Lewistown, you get out of jail, a couple of miraculous circumstances that we'll maybe save for another story.
Yeah.
End up in Lewistown. Tell me what happens. You're clean now. You're in recovery. You're in recovery.
Yep. We'll say So one thing I do want to do is I do want to back up just a hair.
Sure.
Because so this is one thing that I really want to get across of what our criminal justice system does is that, you know, so I went in front of a judge and that judge told me, he said, all you ever do is fight. That's all you've ever done, and that's all you're ever going to do, and you deserve to be in prison, and sentenced me to 15 years, right? And I go back, and I look at my very first experience in my neighborhood where I had to fight. Of course I did, because that's where I grew up. I grew up in low-income area where that's what we did, right? And so, you know, I just wanted to get that point across that, you know, there has to be a better way than to send somebody somewhere where they have to be more violent.
Sure.
Because that's all prison is it's more violent. It's a networking system. You know, it's all of those things. And so, you know, that's something that I'm passionate about now.
But, okay.
So, yeah. So I come out of prison and I get paroled to Lewistown, Montana. I'm living with my grandmother. She passed away about a month after I get out. So then my mom moves in with me. And so now I'm basically my mom's main caregiver. It takes me a long time to get a job coming out of prison, you know, as a person with a felony.
Sure.
It's very hard to find a job. Jobs that they're posting in the newspaper don't want to hire you, right? And so I finally get a job. So in that 12-step program that I was telling you about, I meet this guy. His name is Brett, and 25 years of recovery, offers me a job fencing. So I go work for this guy fencing for 2 years, you know, and I can't even explain how much that him and just the program and all of that, they all changed my life, right? Like I finally meet these people in my life that are healthy people that actually do care about what happens in my life. You know, I mean, this guy, like we would go to work and I would be struggling with something and I'd be crying and we would spend a half a day not even working.
And with he's ministering to you, basically.
Right,
huh?
Basically. You know, he's helping me through these problems. And, you know, those are all the things that you find in recovery programs and recovery groups is, you know, people who are willing to sit with you for 4 hours and still pay you.
Sure, yeah.
still like, you know, pay you like you're on the clock and not even think a second thought about it. And sit there and like thinking, oh, this is a waste of my time and blah, blah, blah. And we need to be working. And, you know, he's not thinking any of this stuff. He's just sitting here helping me through talking about my children and talking about some of the things of my past and things that I'm struggling with today with my mom and, you know, all of these things, just supporting me.
Sure.
You know,
great grace. Support.
Yeah.
So you spent a couple of years doing this fencing job with this guy, Brett, right? Who's 23 years into recovery.
So at that point, he was 23 years. Now I believe he's 25. Yep.
Wow, man. Yep. That's just terrific. And he had such a huge impact.
Oh, such a, you know, I mean, like him, his entire family, you know, I mean, this is a, every single morning I go to his house to go to work, you know, so I'm meeting his son, who's now a senior in high school, wow. His daughter, who's now a freshman in high school, his amazing wife, like, you know,
they just welcomed you in.
Yeah. And I still see these guys, you know. I just ran into him at a restaurant the other day and sat down with them. Katie and I sat down. And,
cool.
You know, but that's what you find is this community.
Yep. And it's a different community than the one you had before, huh?
It's a community that loves you regardless of your past, your mistakes, doesn't ask anything from you. I mean,
doesn't expect you to fight in order to get your stat. Well, they expect you to fight, but in a different way.
Right. Every day, right? Yeah. Every day, but, you know, for a better life.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Cool. Well, talk to me a little bit about how you met Chelsea and how you got into peer support then.
Yeah. So I met Chelsea through a mutual friend of it that's in the program. Yeah, so I started kind of hanging out with this guy that I meet in a program, and going over to her house and hanging out with them and their kids and watching Braves games because we're all Braves fans.
What?
And, yeah, oh yeah,
Atlanta, huh?
Braves fans, Grizz fans.
Okay,
and watching fights and all this stuff, and at some point Chelsea says, you know, we're hiring for this peer support specialist job, and I think you would be great at it.
Let's back up real quick. Who's Chelsea? Chelsea was on the Megan podcast,
she was.
Too. She's a nurse care coordinator, correct?
She is. Yep. Okay. She's a care coordinator for the Meadowlark Initiative, and okay. So she's my coworker. We're very extremely close now.
So she was the one that was like, I work at this place, and we've got this peer support position open.
Yeah, you know, I want to share like some of my feelings when she says this. I'm like, that's not going to happen. Like, I'm a person with a felony. They're not going to hire me. There's not even any point. Like, I've never even thought in my lifetime to look under a clinic for a job.
Right.
You know, and I'm like,
no medical experience, got a felony. the odds are completely stacked against me.
There's
right?
no way, right? Yeah. So I'm like, well, whatever, you know, I guess. And so I've never really even built a resume in my life, right? So now Chelsea and her husband are sitting here helping me
Amazing.
Type up a resume, and we built this resume, and I turn it in, and I'm like, whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
And then I get this interview, and this interview just goes great, right? And I'm like, wow. So then I get told that I'm hired. And so in this interview, though, I've shared my entire background, right? I've shared
total transparency,
everything, yeah. Right? And that's why they hired me, right? Like, they're like, oh, this guy has this lived experience of, you know, he's done these things, and that's going to be an asset for peer support. So let me just jump into what peer support is,
please,
right?
Please do.
So peer support specialist is so if you break it down, you have behavioral health, right? So you have mental health, and you have substance use disorders, and all of that comes together for behavioral health. And then you have a peer support specialist, which is a peer, which is you and I, two people of the same kind of lived experiences in the same place, you know, just sitting down relating to each other. And so that's what I do, is I work with people who have mental health and substance use disorders. And I do that based on my own lived experience, sharing those lived experiences as hope that, see, there is hope that I've been where you are, maybe not exactly where you are, but I've been there.
Yes.
And this is where I am now, and this is possible.
A partner.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
So walking alongside them, right?
Yes, yes, sir.
You know?
So they saw, you went through the interview, they saw, oh, this guy, he definitely has the lift experience. Right,
yeah, I definitely have the qualifications. Because
you're completely transparent with them.
Right, definitely have the qualifications, right? So I get told I have this job, but they're also doing a background check, right?
Naturally.
And so... I just asked Chelsea so many times. I'm like, are you sure?
How am I going to pass a background
Right. I'm like, I know. I already can tell you what my background check is going to come back as. And I said, so are you guys sure that I have this job? Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, we all know your past. And I'm like, okay. So I put in my 2 weeks at this fencing. And that is literally the very last day of my 2 weeks. It's a Friday. I'm headed to Great Falls. I believe it was like 4:43 or 4:53 or something. I'm headed to Great Falls to watch my sponsor speak at a treatment facility. And I get a call from HR that says, sorry, but you're no longer eligible for this job because your background check has come back. I mean, you want to talk about like sinking, right? Like everything that I thought, like here I am, I'm like, oh, see, my life can change. My life can be different. And then now I'm like, oh, see, my life can't be different. This is where I'm stuck for the rest of my life.
It kind of blew your world up.
It really did. So like I instantly, so I'm maybe 15 miles out of Great Falls, and I just had gotten paid. I no longer have a job. We've found somebody that's been taking care of my mother. So I'm going,
you're
going to
blow it up.
Yeah. I'm like, Matt, I don't even have to go back to Lewistown, right? Like, what's the point? Like, I have money. I have no job anymore. My mom is taken care of. And then instantly I do what they tell you to do, which is, you know, the most cliche thing in the world, play the tape forward. And I do, and I said, okay, the money that's in my bank, it's going to be gone today. I'm homeless, basically. I'll be homeless. I'm on parole. My parole officer is going to be looking for me.
You're
going
to go back to jail. Yeah.
So eventually. Now I'm going back to prison for the rest of my sentence because now I've absconded. And I'm going to be hiding out in somebody's house, too scared to go outside because I know that the SWAT team's out there just waiting for me.
Such
just
like, wisdom to think that way, man.
You know? And I'm like, no, I'm going to go to the speaker meeting, you know, afterwards, talk to my sponsor, call Brett, call my other, I talked to maybe five people that are in the program that, you know, that day about everything that I'm going through. And that's the biggest thing that I want people to get out of this kind of is that you need that community because if I didn't have that community, and I want to share like, because so I called one person and they didn't answer. I called another person and they didn't answer. And I called another person.
And at that point, you could have just given up and said, this cards are stacked against me.
Right.
Nobody wants to be involved.
Finally,
in my life.
Like the fifth person answered that phone call. But what would have happened if I didn't have five people to call?
Yeah, yeah.
So building that
You had to build a huge community.
Build that community and build that support system so that when you're going through those crises and you call one person, they don't answer. It's just like, oh, well, they didn't answer, so I might as well just the heck with it, right? Yeah. No, I have more people to call. I have, you know, I probably could have called 30 people, right?
What a massive victory, Ty, at this moment. And I think what I'm seeing here is, if I'm hearing you correctly, it started in your head.
Right.
Right. It started in your mind. And then from there, it branched out into this recovery community that you had built. But you had to first face that battle in your own mind, right? And say, okay, no, I'm going to take this to its logical end. So you're thinking rationally.
Right.
You're not thinking irrationally at this point. Take it to its logical end. Is that what I want to do?
Right.
And then you have to answer that question.
Right. which is one of the biggest things of recovery, right? Is starting to change that irrational thinking that you're thinking, that you're talking about, of, you know, like, oh, this is just the end of the world and this always happens. And no, this doesn't always happen. Yes, it's happened in the past, but this does not always happen. And, you know, that's one of the biggest things that substance use disorder does to the brain, is you don't think about your consequences. All you think about is that instant, I feel better right now.
Yep.
And you're not thinking about the long term. None of that stuff comes to your mind. It's all that instant.
Yep.
This feels good. My problems feel bad. I'm going to stay away from my problems and I'm going to get this because this feels good on my brain right now. Right.
Yep. So did you end up getting the job, or was it just a massive closed door still?
No. So the gals that were in my interview with me, really went to fight for me. Chelsea, Megan Doyle, Pam Ponich, they went to bat for me and really talked to the organ. So I had a choice to go ask my old boss for my job back or wait. And I thought, you know what? I know this is going to turn out, because I know this is the way, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I'm supposed to do with my life. I've always wanted to help people, and here's my chance to pay back what people have given to me. And so I just waited, because Megan and Chelsea and Pam are telling me, we got your back. We got your back. And I just, for once in my life, said, you know what? I'm going to trust this process. And they did it. They went to bat for me. They fought for me. Mm. And a month later, I'm working at One Health, doing all my intake stuff, doing all my onboarding, and, you know, this surreal feeling of, you know, taking, you know, I mean, Chelsea's at a desk next to me taking pictures of me on my first day at work, you know, hilarious, with my headset on at my desk with this peer support job that, you know, this job, like, I don't know, I can't even explain, you sure, know, sure. what that is
so,
like.
So you're helping people.
Yeah.
Now, is that fulfilling for you? How does that play into your recovery?
So the only thing I can say is that it's the most fulfilling thing that I've ever felt in my life. So when I have somebody that comes in that's struggling, and I can empathize with that and know, like, coming in with their, because their kids have been removed, and they're coming in.
You know what that's like.
I do. And I always try to reaffirm, is that I don't know exactly what they're feeling, but I do, I can relate, right? And then to watch them a year later get their kids back, or a few months later get their kids back, and be having these crazy, you know, these doing amazing. And then I worked with them with peer support. So, and they have a 15-year-old son that's struggling. So now they want me to do peer support with their 15-year-old son. I mean, there's nothing that is more rewarding than that in the world, of being able to help somebody who is down at the bottoms, and you see them just thriving and loving life. And, you know,
I was going to ask you to tell a story about how you help someone, and then I thought, well, we just did a whole podcast with Megan Dobbs about how you have helped someone through this, and how you've taken them through the peer support process and through the doula process. So instead of asking you to tell another story, I will just encourage our listeners to go listen to that Megan Dobbs episode. Real quick, so you're helping people now. You met a girl.
I meet a woman. So, so the crazy thing is I actually meet this woman when I first get out of prison. And she's my doctor. And I she walks into the office, and I'm like, wow, this lady is beautiful, you know? And I'm like, yeah, right, she's a doctor.
Out of my league.
Way out of my league, right? So here I am, 2 years later, working at the same clinic as this lady, and she's coming in, and so she was also the doctor that was present at Megan Dobbs's birth.
Yes.
And so we've worked together. She's coming in and talking to me, and Chelsea's like, Ty, I think she likes you. And I'm like, yeah, right. You know, like, this isn't even crossing my mind, right? Like,
that is a different reality.
This is doctor, you know. And sure enough, I'm like, well, what the heck, you know? Wow. So I'm, hey, would you like to go out? I text her, or I think I teamed her, whatever. And I said, hey, how would you like to go out on a date? And the instant reply was, well, maybe you need to find a new primary care provider. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty straightforward.
That's a yes. I'll take that as a yes. Yeah.
So the next day I go down, get a new primary care provider. And yeah. And we've started just dating
super cool, man.
And things are amazing. She's amazing. Most amazing woman that I've ever met. Just accepts me for me and actually likes my vulnerability and my past and understands my past, but also sits with me because I still struggle a lot, right? Like, I still go through mental health struggles.
Yes, sir.
I have what's called co-occurring disorders. So I not only have substance use, but I have mental health as well. And so I have my downs.
Yeah.
And she helps, she sits with me through that, and she works with me through that. So, you know, I thought, I have to do this, right? Like, this is the most amazing person that I've ever met in my life. So I call her parents that live in New Jersey, and I say, hey, I'd like to ask you for your daughter's hand in marriage. Mm. They say yes. We plan this whole thing for Christmas Day, you know. So they get this huge box, put books in the bottom of it, fill it with the little styrofoam peanuts, and we put this little bag in there with the ring in it.
Oh, hilarious.
And this is a ring that was given to me from my mom. That's my mom's ring. And I put it in there, and of course Christmas rolls around, and we save that present for last, and she's kind of starting to catch on because we're not opening that one yet. It's last. It's last. So she finally opens it, digs in, is digging around, pulls out a book, and I'm like, no, that's not your present. And she digs around some more and pulls out another book, and I'm going,
bypass the books completely.
Right. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, maybe this was not a good idea as the stress is building.
Let me find it for you.
And the anxiety is building, and I'm like, oh my. So I help her kind of find it. I'm like, okay, it's in this corner right here. And she pulls it out, you know, and of course, so I get down on my knee and ask her, and she says yes. And so now Katie and I are engaged.
Awesome.
And living together. We got three dogs, and
about it.
Yeah.
Super cool, man.
Life is amazing, but that's also, you know, the thing is, life is not amazing every day. I still struggle with substance use disorder, and I still struggle with mental health. And so sometimes it's a daily fight, you know, but
Ty, thanks so much, man, for telling the story. What a great story. I just, you know, the reason why we do this, I just want to say this here at the end, is for anyone who struggles with addiction currently, these stories are meant to provide hope,
right?
For you, hope that you too can overcome this struggle. You're not bound to it for the rest of your life. And if we can, we'd like to provide you with hope and also connect you with resources,
right?
That you need to begin your recovery journey. So Ty, I think what we'll do is we'll just put your email in the notes for anyone who listens. They can just have immediate access. Are you Are you okay with that?
That's, yeah, I'm 100%. Yeah,
we'll put your email in there. And if you want to contact Ty and begin your recovery journey, would you please just send him an email? It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be detailed. Just, you know, help, right? Just help. So, awesome. We'll do that. Ty, thanks for coming in.
Man, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just want to say, too, as we're here at the end, if you enjoyed this episode, will you please share it with someone you think would benefit from listening to this story? Would you also leave us a 5-star review in your podcast app of choice and follow us to receive the latest episodes? And thanks a lot for tuning in.